All right, here we go. Parashas Noach. Noach, such an interesting character. And really, Rashi tells us the tension of Noach from the beginning. But let's just do some introductory remarks here. I probably said this before. I'm not sure if I said it in this class. I've definitely said it a few times. Not sure if I've said it in Detroit at all. But there's a tendency for some, maybe out of the, what should we say? I don't want to call it a Yetzer Hara, but it really is a Yetzer Hara, just too strong of a word. The tendency, the desire to be different and to be novel. There's a tendency for many when they look at Parshas Noach to point out Noach's flaws. And that is something which has basis. You know, it's not like Chazal didn't pick up on it, and it's not like Rashi didn't have some kind of, it's not like Rashi doesn't imply that in a couple spots. There is definitely something to work with on that, and much of that comes to the tension at the beginning of the Parsha. I see Sharon. Hi, Sharon. Hi, Shiffy. Welcome. Good to see you. Rashi points out on the first pasuk of the Parsha, Eila told us Noach ish tzaddik. Tamim haya, right? Noach was righteous and he was perfect. But then it adds one word, bidorosav, in his generation. And this one word is what really precipitates all of the discussion around who he was. It sort of, it puts a tinge on the rest of the story in terms of figuring out who Noach was. And Rashi tells us, what does bedorosav mean? Bedorosav could either mean in his generation to the positive or in his generation to the negative. The only reason he was so righteous is because the rest of his generation was so terrible. Or the only reason he was so righteous, that he was righteous even in his generation, where he could have been even more righteous if he had the resources, if he had sort of the environment that could have encouraged him along. And this is interesting because, you know, typically we don't have that kind of machlokas within Chazal. We either have a positive framework or we have a negative framework, especially with these kinds of biblical characters. But as we know, we're not dealing with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov yet. We're dealing with Noach, who's pre Bris Ben Abisarim. He's not even Jewish. So the question is really how to understand Noach. And on a sort of psychological level, this distinction between whether you're encouraged to be better in your generation or whether you are encouraged to be different in your generation, right? These two different interpretations of Noah, I feel like, you know, exists even today. There are different people who respond differently in different environments. There are some people, and this, you know, I remember having this debate. You know, it's not like really a debate. Everyone's got their own opinion about whether you should go to a Jewish college or should you go to a secular college. And there's a lot to talk about. But one of the interesting distinctions between going to an environment which is specifically Jewish versus an environment which is specifically secular is how does the individual react to that environment? There are some individuals who react in a contrarian way, that whatever environment they're put in, if the trend, the popular thing to do is X, so then they'll do Y, right? So for those types of people, going to a place like YU where more Jewish culture is, you know, all around you, so maybe you're going to react and express your individualism by being different from that and not doing all of that Jewish cultural, you know, activity. But for some people, they are very much taken along with their environment, and therefore for them, maybe Jewish culture would be better. It depends, and there are a lot of other factors, obviously, too, but the question is, what kind of person was Noach? Was Noach the kind of person that would be swayed along with his environment, or would he be was he the type of person that was against his environment? He was always contrarian to them. So that's the tension within Noach here. But the truth is, I feel like Noach always gets a lot of attention, and we're going to talk about something else. We're going to talk about the Dor HaFlaga, the Migdal Bavel, right? The Tower of Babel, right? Very interesting story. But before we get to there, so we have to at least talk about Noach a little bit. I would feel a little too guilty to go through Noach without talking about Noach. So we have Noach, we have the Teva, obviously, we have the Mabul. And if you remember last year, we spoke about such a clear and present imagery that the Torah seems to be lining up for us in the story, the retelling of it, between the raven and the dove, right? It's such so interesting to look at the psukim and to see the distinctions of descriptions. What was the raven's job? What was the raven's actual behavior? Or the lack thereof, based on the psukim, if you remember last year. For those of you who weren't with us in the class last year, so then I recommend finding it online, because it's really such an interesting, you know, in the end of the day, you see the whole story of Noach, and you see the whole story of coming out of the Teva and engaging and embracing a new existence, a new world. You see it in a very different light when you understand what Noach's, or at least what one particular interpretation of Chazal's understanding of Noach meant for, you know, how to see the previous world, how to see the next world. Think about the raven as sort of the, you know, the one that's going to see the death of the previous generation, because the raven is more of a predator, and the raven is one that sees carcasses, as opposed to the dove, which comes back with new vegetation and comes with a new world. And what does that mean for Noach, and how did Noach interact with the raven, interact with the dove? Fascinating. If those of you remember, probably remember at least sort of the general distinctions we made there. But fascinating, you know, the darkness and the doom and gloom of the raven versus the purity and the clean, you know, hopefulness of the dove. It's just a stark contrast in the story, and a fascinating thing to look at through the prism of Chazal. So I encourage you to look at that class from last year. You can find it on YU Torah. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, like all of our classes. I have regards from Mark Berkman, who said he listened to our class last week and really enjoyed it. So we miss the Berkmans. They're in Eretz Yisrael now, and they're listening to this one also. So thanks for listening. So you can take a page out of the Berkmans' book and listen to last year's class as well. Either way, we go through the Mabul, we go through the story of the dove and the raven, and then you come to an interesting sort of segue. You know, not really a segue as much as it is sort of like a bridge. Right, Perek Yud, the 10th Perek of Bereishis, is basically telling us, okay, the new world order is upon us, right? The Teva has landed, and then they have a bunch of different generations, and it goes through tons of generations. I'm not sure how many generations it is. It looks like about 10 generations or so. The children of Shem, Ham, and Yefes, and their children. I don't know if it was 10. There's a lot of children named, but I don't know. I can't count the generations right now. But either way, then you come to Perek Yud Aleph. Then you come to the 11th Perek, right? This is towards the end of Noah. And it's squeezed in between two genealogical listings, right? You have Perek Yud, which we just went through, Shem, Ham, and Yefes' children. And you have the end of Perek Yud Aleph. You have from Perek Yud until the end of the Parsha, really, or until Maftir at least. You have more generations that gets you to Nahor and Haran, and of course Avram Avinu. And you see the story there. I think we talked about this a little bit last year also on Parshas Lech Lecha, the end of Noach versus the beginning of Lech Lecha. Fascinating stuff there too. We'll have to talk about something else next week. But squeezed in between these two lists of genealogies, squeezed in between these two lists of coming from Noach until Avram Avinu, you have the story of the Dor HaFlaga. And it's very interesting when you think about, the listing of individuals and the segue of a community, you start thinking a little bit about that contrast. The whole parak of Perek Yud is talking about this individual is born to that individual, this individual, that individual. Ultimately, you come to Perek Yud Aleph, and that's the first source on the sheet here. The entire land was one language. It's a very interesting way to say it. Mefarshim talk about it. Mefarshim talk about everything. There's so much to talk about. But you see Rashi tells us Lashon HaKodesh. Right? It was one language, and it was the language of the Jewish people. What exactly does that mean at that time? I'm not 100% sure. But as you know from day school education, you know that soon to be, they're not going to be of one language anymore. Okay, so then they're all one language. What exactly is it? Kol Haaretz? What Eretz are we talking about? Unclear. But it does say in the next pasuk, Vayehi bin Nas'am Mikedem. So first of all, it's already interesting to point out that they're migrating as a group, Binas'am, when they were moving eastward, or from the east, Mikedem, from the east. All right, so they're going westward, presumably, but they're going en masse. Now, what exactly is happening? I'm not sure. I would assume that there might be some kind of agricultural, you know, incentive. Maybe there's a weather issue that they want to get into a better climate. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Rashi gives a little backstory, but not exactly why they're moving. Vayimtzu bika be'eretz Shinar vayeshvu sham, and they come to a valley in the land of Shinar. Presumably, Shinar is the name of a person. Either way, they get over there and they settle there. Vayomru ish areihu. This is a very interesting phrase. One person says to his fellow. Okay, Re'ehu, as we know from V'yahavta l'recha kamocha, even those who weren't in the rebuke class. By the way, we're starting tomorrow night a new halacha from Gemara Shir, new topic. At least we've been off for a couple months now, month and a half, and hopefully we'll do another interpersonal mitzvah, something more specific than rebuke. But either way, for those who remember the rebuke classes, V'yahavta l'recha kamocha is a very operative word, the word re'acha, your fellow, right? Chazal interpret, or at least the Mefarshim interpret, that re'acha means that you have some kind of commonality. You have some kind of shared value system. Ish al re'eyu here presumably also means that there's some kind of shared value system. Over there, by v'yahavta l'recha kamocha, it means that your fellow is a fellow in terms of mitzvos, right? That you have a shared commitment to mitzvos. What exactly is the re'acha here? I'm not sure. But if there's some kind of connection, we already know from the beginning of the pasuk that they traveled together. Binasa'am mikedem, they came from the east as a group. And now they're saying that Yomru ish areihu, they said to each other, Hava nilbina levenim. It's a very interesting word, nilbina. Nilbina is presumably just the verb form of levenim. Right? You see the word, it's almost like it's repeated. But nilbina is the verb form in the plural form, plural future tense form of making levenim. What are levenim? They're bricks, right? Make some kind of brick, right? They're in a valley, so maybe there's some kind of clay at the bottom of the valley. Some of the freshmen talk about the types of materials they had or didn't have because they were in a valley. Unclear what exactly it means. But then they say, v'nisrefa l'srefa, right? You burn them in order to harden them, right? It says here in the translation that you have here, and burn them to hard, and burn them hard, okay? You burn them into a hardened substance, right, to make bricks. Vatihi lahem halevena la'evan, and then this brick, I guess, which would literally be some kind of softer material beforehand, but then you would burn it, and then it would become la'evan, and it would become harder, like a rock. V'hachemar haya lahem lachomer. And the bitumen would become the mortar. Exactly how they did that, unclear. We know that they burned the material to make it harder, but we don't know how they made the chemar into chomer. Interesting wordplay here, either way. So, they're making bricks, okay? We don't know why they're making bricks yet, which is interesting because they know they want to build, but they haven't yet made a building project. Imagine if you were trying to build something and you don't know what you were going to build. You just started building materials, right? You just started making bricks. Well, what are we building, right? It's almost as if they were committed to building something before they even had a project in mind. That's what it sounds like. Otherwise, they would have said, you know, I want to build this, and then they would have made the bricks, right? Seems like it's out of order. Either way, So then they say, Vayomru. Now, what's interesting about this, I wish we could be in person for all this habereshah stuff. There's so much to talk about and to really discuss, to unpack. There's a big difference between the beginning of Pasuk Gimel and the beginning of Pasuk Dalet. Right? The beginning of Pasuk Gimel already tells us that there's a conversation happening. Right? There are two people talking to each other. So presumably, you don't need to then tell us again that somebody's talking. Right? Somebody's already talking in Pasuk Gimel. And yet the beginning of Pasuk Dalet says the word Vayomru again. Why do we need to know the word Vayomru again? They're already talking. Just continue talking. Right? The first Pasuk said, Hava nilbanala venim, yisrafelasreva, atilahem halavinala evan, vachimar hayalahem lachomer. So maybe the narrator of the Torah, right? Hashem is saying, unquoting, right? Finishing the quotes, and then is saying, and they made these things, and they're going to use them for bricks, fine. But then when he reintroduces it, when Hashem reintroduces the speaker, whoever the speaker is, right? Sort of this imagined, paradigm speaker of this community. Vayomru. What's missing from Dalet that was in Gimel? The first Pasuk Gimel says, Vayomru ish el re'ehu. And they said, one man to his fellow. Good Robin. One man to his fellow. And now Hashem reintroduces, right? Hashem reintroduces the conversation in Pasuk Dalet, and it just says Vayomru. It's not, there's no Ish L'Re'ehu anymore. Now, whether or not there's something to be said for that, I don't know. Maybe by the end of the class there will be. But, maybe it's just Hashem reintroducing it. Presumably it's a purposeful omission. Vayomru. And they said, not Ish L'Re'ehu anymore. Hava nivne lanu ir. Let us build a city. Umigdal v'rosho b'shamayim. And we'll build a tower, and its head will be in heaven. V'nase lanu shem. And we will make a name for ourselves. Pen nafutz al pnei chol haaretz. Now this is the most interesting part of the whole thing, because we don't know what they're talking about, but literally it translates to, let's make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered all over the world. That's what are you talking about? Why are you going to be scattered all over the world? What happens? What are you afraid of that's going to scatter you all over the world? So, just grammatically, whenever you have a because, you have to look at what the predicate was that caused the because. The only problem here is that there are two things that they talked about, or three things really. If you look at Pasuk Dalet again carefully, Vayomru, Hava, number one, Nivna Lanu Ir, let's build a city. Second, Migdal, Virosho Bashamayim, let's build a tower in the heaven. And then thirdly, Nasa Lanu Shem, make for ourselves a name. So these three things, somehow, maybe one of them, maybe all three of them, are going to prevent whatever nafutz al pnei kol haaretz is. Whatever the scattering is going to be, they think, their plan is that these three things, maybe one, maybe two, maybe all three, is going to prevent that scattering. So we could think all day about what in the world they might be talking about. But perhaps the most obvious one that jumps out at us, being that this is in the aftermath of the Mabul, being that it's in the aftermath of the flood, would be that maybe they're worried about another flood. Now, there have been some generations that have passed already since Noah, as we just pointed out in Perek Yud, right? There were generations before this story happened. Otherwise, we're dealing with Noah's family that's talking about that, right? So there's already a little bit of I guess this is not a great word to use, but a dilution of the message from Noah, right? The severity of the message that was given to Noah has been blunted a little bit, because it's been a few generations, and they don't have sort of maybe the cognizance of Noah and his generation, and therefore maybe they're thinking to themselves that this flood wasn't God-given, or this flood wasn't premeditated for a specific reason, and maybe it's just, you know, something that happens in the world, that there's water sometimes that just wipes everybody out. They heard about the flood. You know, no one's going to deny that there was a flood. You probably see destruction still from such a thing. So they say to themselves, let's build a fortress of sorts. Let's build something very tall, which is going to protect us. We can sort of be above the water. That's what you might think in terms of just logic, in terms of the sequence of the parsha, the chronology of events. If you look at Rashi, however, Rashi tells us, I didn't quote all of Rashi, but Rashi says on Pasuk Beis, no, Pasuk, sorry, Pasuk Gimel, where does he say it? Sorry, give me a second. Where does Rashi say it? Hold on. Rashi says, it's before that. Rashi on Pasuk Aleph says, Devarim achadim, ba'o be'etza achas ve'armu lo kol himenu shi'yavur lo asal yonim, na'ala l'rakia v'nasi imo milchama. They wanted to wage war on God, right? This is how you learn it in day school, because that's what Rashi says. Rashi basically determined day school curriculum for the rest of Jewish history. So we learn Rashi, and that's what Rashi says, that they're trying to fight against God. Davar achar al yechido shel olam, whatever that means, the oneness of the world, or the oneness of Hashem in the world. Davar achar dvar machadim, amru, bo v'nase, shanim harakia mismotate. Right, sometimes the rakia, the firmament just collapses. So therefore, we have to do something which is going to prevent the firmament from collapsing again. It collapsed a bunch of years ago with Noah, and it caused this huge flood. We have to prevent it from collapsing again. So in a strange way that we don't understand, because we have a lot more knowledge than they had back then. But they thought that they could create some kind of buttress for the firmament, that they would put it up there, and it would sort of keep the clouds, you know, protected, and somehow it would prevent the rain from coming down in the way it did for the flood. How exactly that works, I have no idea. But once you understand that...
Rabbi Ken?
Yeah, Dina.
I always thought, growing up, that the tower was supposed to be to get closer to God. That was the point of the tower, was to get closer.
Well, it was to get closer so that they could fight against him. That's usually how Rashi's understood. Maybe there are other explanations that may make it more, I guess, profitable read or positive read. But that's what Rashi says. Nasa imo milchama. Meaning, yeah, they're trying to get closer to God, but so that they could fight God. What exactly that means, again, I don't know, right? They assumed he was in heaven. They assumed that there was a physical nature to him. So they created this tower. One way or another, either they're worried about water, or they're worried about Hashem himself. And that's presumably what it means at the end of the pasuk. Pen nafutz al pnei kol haaretz, lest we be scattered across the land. So what are they trying to do in order to undo that? So either the scattering is going to happen through another flood, in which case they're building up this tower in order to buttress the firmament, or they're worried about Hashem himself, and therefore they're making this tower in order to fight against Hashem. If you look at Rashi in source number 2 that you have, Rashi on Perek Dalet, Pasuk Dalet, Pen Nafutz, Shelo Yavi Aleinu Shum Makah Lahafitzenu Mikan, that he should not bring any plague upon us to scatter us from here. So that's very interesting. That Rashi sounds like he's siding with one of his explanations, that they're worried more about Hashem himself, or what Hashem was going to bring into the world, which could also be the flood. But either way, somehow this city, right? Remember again, three things that are going to keep them together. Number one, is the city. Number two is the tower, and number three is this name. Okay. So what does Rashi mean? If you look at the Maharal in source number three, the Gor Aryeh points out, Shlo yavi aleinu maka, perish, bishvil shehayu yureyim. Because they were afraid that something's going to happen to them, some plague is going to come upon them, kitei sheyafutsu, so that they'll be scattered, lefikach banu, or banu, es hamigdal lilchom neged Hashem Yisbarach, kidei shelo yafutsu misham. They built the tower in order to directly fight with Hashem, and that's going to prevent them from being scattered, because if they defeat Hashem, so they'll defeat whatever plan Hashem has for scattering them. Ki ha-migdal ha-yaneged Hashem Yisbarach, that's what it meant, v'chein l'lashon ha-sheni. And so too it is for Rashi's second explanation. She'ratu la'aso semuchos al-arkir shalo yismotet, shalo yavi HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleihem abo k'dei she'yafutsu. Right? So it's either that they're fighting directly with sort of physical combat of some sort with Hashem, or they're working against Hashem's presumed plan that he's going to bring a flood. Okay? So this is how we understood it. The Mizrahi, however, Mizrahi, whose name was, I don't remember, I don't know his name. Eliyahu Mizrahi, I think his name was. 15th century super commentary on Rashi, just like the Gor Aryeh, just like the Maharal. He explains Rashi to be saying something else. If you look at source number four, he says, Shelo yavi aleinu shumaka lahafitzenu mikan, lo pen nafutz me'atzmenu. They're not worried that they're going to be scattered from their own decision. They're not worried that everyone's going to move away. But rather, Kiblo binyan ha'ir nami. Even without the city, im he maskimim shelo yafutsu, rak sheyu kulam mekubatsim, die. Right? So he implicitly asks the question, why do they have to build a city? If they're trying to create some kind of communal commitment to each other, that we're going to stick together and we're not going to scatter over other places, we're not going to move anywhere, so then just say that. Why do you have to build anything to create that connection? Aval, says the Mizrahi, im yiya perish pen nafutz, pen yavi aleinu shumaka lafitzenu, if it's because of Hashem, az ya binyan ha'ir siba, then the city will become the reason shelo yafutsu, that they're not going to scatter. What does that mean? The city. He didn't say anything about the tower yet. That if you build the city, then people won't move away. Ki ana yimtzu'u ir benuya. Sheikantzu ba kemo shehayu noag nehugim. So says the Mizrahi, if there was some kind of calamity, if there was some kind of terrible thing, people are going to think to themselves that we're going to move somewhere else. We're going to find another place to settle down. The only problem is they've only got one city and they've spent all this time building it up. They've built houses, they've built roads, they've built, you know, they've built, you know, businesses, they've built structures, they're building a huge tower. Says the Mizrahi, the point is not to prevent a calamity. The point is to prevent the scattering once the calamity comes. That if you build a strong enough community, if you build the structures to the extent that people are going to be proud of the place that they're living in, so even when something terrible happens, they're not going to feel like they have to move away. Right? And you can imagine a vagabond culture where you go here to there in order to prevent, you know, in order to escape some kind of difficulty, some kind of bad weather, some kind of, you know, you maxed out the land and the fertility of it. So you would think that they would keep moving. So here, what you find is that there's a very interesting, suburban planning committee going on. Maybe this is Pasuk Gimel. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. Hava nil bana levenim. Let's make strong building materials. Let's make stones that will be more formidable, more significant, and more permanent than just maybe a flimsy tent or some kind of, you know, under a tree shade or whatever they would use back then, a cave or some kind. They're trying to create a community. They're trying to create a physical community that will keep them together despite whatever comes their way. And then something gets corrupted. Maybe. This is my creative license working here between Gimel and Dalet. Something becomes corrupted, and then they have this different plan. This is how the Mizrahi is understanding Pasuk Dalet, but presumably you can apply that to Pasuk Gimel also. V'yiyah, if you look at the end of source number 4, V'yiyah pen nafutz tam al ha'ir, lo al ha'migdal. The preventative measure to not make them scatter is to build the city, not the tower. Lo al ha'migdal. Kitam ha'migdal, the reason for the tower was lismo harakia shelo yismotet. It was in order to buttress the support the firmament. That was a separate thing. There are two purposes here. There are two goals, or really three goals. Two general goals. One is to create a structure and a city that they'll be proud of, that they can stay in, no matter what happens. And then number two is to ward off any threats. There are two possible threats. One is Hashem and one is the flood. In their eyes, obviously. So says the Mizrahi, we just said that there are two, we just said that there are three elements to their building process. Number one is building the city. Number two is building the tower. And number three is making them for themselves a name. And we said, well, which one of those is going to prevent the scattering that we're talking about? So the Maharal thinks that nafutz, which is also probably the most conventional understanding of Rashi also, that the scattering will be prevented by the tower. The scattering is referring to the firmament, or it's referring to Hashem himself, referring to some kind of calamity that could come from Hashem that they're going to prevent by building this tower. Says the Mizrahi, it's not true. There was a separate conversation happening, maybe, and this is, again, my own interpretation here, maybe the Mizrahi is getting this from Pasuk Gimel, which talks about the building materials to make them so strong that people are going to want to stay in that city, which is already built up. It's Pasuk Dalet that introduces the threats. It's Pasuk Dalet, which is the problem that they have to build this tower for. Those are two separate conversations. What about the third element? We've talked about element number one, which is the building of the cities. We've talked about element number two, which is the building of the tower. But what does this Na'aseh Lanu Shem make for ourselves a name? This, we can look at a bunch of places. But let's look at Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, because he has a fascinating take. And keep in mind that Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, when he speaks about communities and the importance of, of building things together. So he's thinking in a 19th century worldview. And as you can imagine, there are not only many powers that are fighting for, jurisdiction, but also ideologies. You think about the 19th century, you think about, socialism and communism and things that have, threatened the democracy of the westernizing of society and things like that. So this is maybe something that Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch is responding to. But let's just read Rav Hirsch, and you can make your own judgment call. I actually want to take out my Rav Hirsch because there's some other things that this one doesn't have. It's a long piece, and I bring you the main pieces for the analysis, but he has other lines in here that I want to quote for you afterwards. He says the following. And I hope I got this in the correct order. I think it goes left to right and then left to right again. When the community says, we will make the powers which lie in a community recognized, we will unite our powers to establish ourself. If they, as the herald of God, do not call on the individuals b'shem Hashem to the service of God, but to their own service, Na'aseh Lanu Shem, meaning if they place themselves there instead of a means as an end, then the whole moral future of mankind goes to ruin. then what is almost prophetically said here occurs. Mankind perceives its own powers, and the more originality it used, the more arrogantly comes to believe that the community as such can dispense with God and his laws of morality. I don't know what he's quoting from here. The old people have stone, but we build even where there is no stone. That's what he says. We'll pause there for a second. What's Rehersh saying when he says this? The words Na'aseh Lanu Shem are not themselves a goal as much as they are the purpose of the other two goals, right? Purpose, we said before, Na'aseh, you know, Nivlanu Ir, we're building a city, and then Umigdal Rosh HaBashem, we're building a tower. We talked about how one of those is to create community, a permanent community. One of those is to fight against Hashem. But both of them ultimately are for their own power, for their own self-aggrandizement, that they're thinking of themselves as the new powerful entity in the world. And that's what he says, Na'aseh Lanu Shem. The purpose of all of this building is not for some kind of greater moral, you know, moral society that they're trying to build, but rather for their own propping up, right? To use the imagery of the tower, right? They're trying to build themselves up. Na'aseh Lanu Shem, let's make a reputation for ourselves. Then the idol of an empty purpose is created. This is such a fascinating, the way he phrases that is so interesting. The idol of an empty purpose, right? We think of idols, right? When we think of an idol, I-D-O-L, right? You think of an idol, you think of something which people think have powers, people at least attribute to some kind of loftier, you know, skill set that they're able to do certain things. It says, no, the idol of an empty purpose. What's the idol? An idol which brings no happiness and to which the individual has to give up the whole of his existence and the community its allegiance to the laws of morality, right? It's something which is completely empty because basically what it means is we're just fighting for ourselves. We're pretending like there's some greater purpose. We're going to do this, you know, well, we're going to build a permanent city. We're going to build a tower. But ultimately, it's for to make ourselves, you know, to think highly of ourselves. That's not really a purpose. That's for your own, you know, idolizing yourselves. However, when that happens, individuals, of course, must weep when one of them falls. But at the building of the fame of the community, the toll of human lives is not counted. Right? When you're dealing with individuals who care about individuals, so then there's a terrible consequence if someone passes away. But if you're dealing with making a name for the community, and there's nothing in terms of the individual's purpose, so then the individual gets lost. Remember, right, think about, you know, you think in the back of your mind, sorry. Sorry, someone forgot to put my phone on silent, and okay. So hopefully people can hear me again. It looks like you can. So says Rav Hirsch, the communal sort of power grab that's going on here is really at the expense of the individual. The community says v'nisrefa l'srefa. He's, I think, making a drasha here. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell in the English. The original is in German, so I definitely don't know what understand what that means. But nisrefa l'srefa means let's burn something to the ground. Whatever it is, as long as it furthers the building of our fame, it is to be used. Right? It's destructive in its planning. The individual believes he has lived enough if he gives up his life. Right? You think that you're doing something for a noble cause. Though it be for an idle cause, if that cause is one on which the community has set its idea of obtaining fame and glory, right? You're dying for the cause. That glory which is content to march triumphantly on over millions of dead bodies. And he says also the same is spiritual and morally. Skip to the next paragraph. Our sages teach us, this is fascinating, this is definitely something where he's talking, he'll say it explicitly, he's talking about, you know, modern day powers that be. Our sages teach us that this undertaking only succeeded under Nimrod's leadership. Nimrod will become more important at the end of the parsha with Avram Avinu. And indeed, it is only a Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem like Nimrod, a hunter like Nimrod, who could move men to such sacrifice. He too could not have succeeded if he had not understood how to make men enthusiastic for his own ends, if he had not known how to make his own fame identical with that of the masses who sacrificed themselves for him, not with gold or possessions. He didn't bribe them with money, but with a little bit of ribbon in the lapel or on the breast. Does a Napoleon or an Alexander understand how to lure the masses for his purpose? What a fascinating phrase from Rav Hirsch. It's so insightful because, unfortunately, we see it today and we'll talk about that soon. If you want to rally a base, you want to rally people together, convince them that they're fighting for something which is, you know, some greater good, right? You'll convince them that you're fighting for Napoleon's army, for all of France. You're fighting for all of Rome, right? All of these different ideas. And you don't have to convince them with bribing them. You can convince them just by the ideal itself. They think that they're serving some greater purpose when they're joining together with such a communal group, with such a large gathering, to such an extent that they're willing to give their lives for that, for that sort of, you know, communal, that communal goal, right? They think it's such a big, higher aspiration that they're willing to sacrifice for it. Explains Rav Hirsch, in this, when we understand this concept, the pen nafutz becomes understandable. What are they worried about? We're going to scatter. We're going to get separated. They feared to cease to form a whole community. They didn't want to ruin this grand, you know, powerful nation that they were creating. What would that matter if the community was only a union to look after the individuals, right? Meaning if the whole purpose of this community was for the sake of each person's own well-being, so then what do you mean that we're going to scatter? If we scatter, that's unfortunate, but the whole purpose of our community is to bolster each other up, to make sure that we're all living up to our personal standards to the best way possible. Says Rav Hirsch, that's obviously not what they wanted. And what was there to fear if all that the community wanted was to enable the laws of morality to be fulfilled in a higher and more perfect degree? What does it matter if they're scattered if you're actually just trying to prop up morality, create a good society where people are upstanding people? If the community is what it should be, even if it consists of millions, it requires no artificial means of holding it together. Right? If the community is created through value systems, that people and individuals are making choices to be better people, moral people, so then you don't need some kind of project. You don't need some kind of artificial means of creativity, artificial means of bringing people together. Because the bond lies in the consciousness of every individual, and its point of union is God. But if it is not there for the sake of the individual, but for the reverse, if it says instead, Na'aseh lanu shem, for the general population, let's make a group identity, then naturally, the individual is only forced or artificially lured to sacrifice himself and be submissive to it. Says Rav Hirsch, you know what this last element was? This last element, this Na'aseh lanu shem, was the entire ultimate motivation and incentive that created the first two. Their whole purpose in creating the city, as opposed to how the Mizrahi sounds, and as opposed to how the Gor Aryeh sounds, wasn't just some kind of, you know, some kind of building project where they were trying to create some kind of a community where they could build together, but it was rather instead a power grab. They were trying to be a powerful nation. They wanted to have the reputation. They wanted to be the first Rome in human history. They wanted to be the powerful nation of France, right? They wanted to be some kind of powerful people. And they were willing to sacrifice for that. And in order to do that, Nimrod convinced them that they were part of this grand plan and that they had to build these grand structures. And Rav Hirsch continues to quote a midrash, which is a very unfortunate midrash, but you might know it from day school again. In source number 6, Rabbi Pinchas Omer, Lo hayu sham avanim livnos esair, v'yes hamigdal, ma hayu osim hayu malavnim levenim besarfin osan ki yotzer cheresh, ad shebanu oso, gavo ha shivim mil, umalos hayu lo mi mizrachu mi ma'aravo, Ilu Shahu Malin Esaladeno Hayu Olin Mizrachal the Ilumal Yodim the Hoyu Ard Maravo, right? He describes the whole building process. They would make bricks and they would situate the building from east to west, and they would come up the ramp, they go down the ramp. Okay. However, says the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, the Imnafal Adam Umeis, and if one person would fall and he would die, he fell off the tower and he would just die. Lo Shmia es Libam Alav. Los samim es libam alav. They didn't care for him. They didn't put their heart towards him. V'im nafla levena achas. However, if one of the bricks fell down, hayu yoshvim ubochin, they would sit and they would cry. V'omrim oy lanu. How terrible for us. Emasai tala acheres tachteha. When are we going to get another brick that can replace that one? Right. So what you see from this Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, exactly how Rav Hirsch is understanding it. They're creating a sense of moral superiority as their building purpose. The purpose of their building is in order for them to feel great about themselves and what they're doing. But they didn't care about each individual. Their community wasn't for the sake of the individual. Their community was at the sacrifice, at the expense of the individual. And this is something we've talked about before in a different context, but I want to take it in a different angle. I remember talking about this. I didn't know when, so I looked it up. And we talked about this in the middle of June. This was a drasha, I believe was my first drasha in Young Israel Oak Park as the rabbi, which is, why did Korach happen specifically when it did? And we went through the Ramban, went through different understandings, and essentially what we said then, we don't have time to go through the whole thing now, what we said then was, it happened in the aftermath of Meraglim. What happened in the aftermath of the Meraglim? The Jewish people lost the communal focus, the communal goal of getting to Eretz Yisrael. And once they lost that goal, that lofty purpose, so then they started infighting, because they weren't building towards that greater purpose. In a similar way, but in an opposite, you know, sort of in the opposite moral sense, they also here wanted to build something together. They had a communal, you know, a communal connection, which caused them to want to go towards something. The only difference was that it wasn't a lofty goal that they were after. The only difference was that in that case, in the case of the Jewish people, they were going to Eretz Yisrael, they were going to start living a life of Torah and mitzvos in a holier land. Here, what are they doing? They're coming together for the sake of just being part of some grand, powerful nation. That's not an actual lofty goal. That doesn't come with the same moral principles that everybody's working towards. If you remember back then, we talked in that class about the first of the seven Sheva Brachos, right? The first of the seven Sheva Brachos is nothing to do with Chasen and Kala. The first of the seven Sheva Brachos is Hakol Bara L'Chvodo. Everything is made for Hashem. What does that have to do with a husband and wife? That's the whole purpose. The whole purpose is that everything that you're going to build together should be towards the whole moral system of Torah and mitzvos. And if you don't have that moral system, so then you're not out for the creating something special. You're out for creating something for yourself. And when it's coming to do something for yourself, so then it's not going to last, because you don't have that kind of commitment. You don't have that kind of willingness to forego your personal desires. We quoted back then a Rashi, a seeming contradiction in Rashi's at the beginning of Bishalach versus at the beginning of Matan Torah. Right in source number 7, Rashi says that the Mitzrim, that the Egyptians were Belev Echad Keish Echad. They were with one heart and they were one person. And Rashi later says a very similar phrase about the Jewish people, Keish Echad Belev Echad. It sounds very similar, but the order is the backwards. And we explained then that the order is all the difference. Because for the Egyptians, what brought them together was that they all had their own same desire. They all wanted to beat the Jews. And that's what brought them together. But it wasn't that they came together in order to accomplish something. They were all personally invested in accomplishing something, and then by happenstance they came together. It's like those, you know, that problematic worldview where, you know, we can be friends as long as we like all the same stuff, right? These, I don't know, you can imagine, I'm not familiar with them. Dating sites, what do you like? I actually don't know. How do secular people date, right? They talk about what sports teams they like, what kind of music they like. Oh, yeah, I like the same sports team. Oh, I like the same music. Let's get married because we like the same things. So obviously that's so superficial. It's only going to last as long as the person cares about sports or as long as the person cares about that music. And all of a sudden you don't care about the same things anymore. So then there's nothing left over about that commitment. That's what happened with the Mitzrim. The Egyptians all cared. Individually, they all wanted to kill the Jews. They all came together after they had that desire. Their desire came, and then they came together. The Jewish people were the opposite. Ki'ish echad, and then belev echad. First, they joined together as a people, and then they had a shared desire. Then they had a shared value system. It was only once they had that common commitment to each other that they could effectively go to that moral, that higher moral purpose of Torah and mitzvos. And similarly here, when it comes to the people of Bavel, they're trying to create Na'aseh Lanu Shem, according to Rav Hirsch, the whole purpose is that we want to be important. We want to feel like we won the game. And therefore, we'll come together. We'll build a tower together. We'll build a city together so that we can all get that personal satisfaction of being on the winning team. But it's not that they actually cared about each other. It's that they actually wanted they wanted to fulfill their own personal, desires of being prominent, of being, part of the Roman Empire, whatever it might be, in their own way. And to this, if you remember, we quoted a story from Malcolm Gladwell, or a study from Malcolm Gladwell in The Tipping Point, where it talks about the importance of community and what the maximum number of people is where you can keep everybody on the same page. If you look at source number 9, over the years, military planners have arrived at a rule of thumb which dictates that functional fighting units cannot be substantially larger than 200 men. Dunbar writes, Dunbar is the name of the rule, the Dunbar rule. This, I suspect, is not simply a matter of how the generals in the rear exercise control and coordination, because companies have remained obdurately stuck at this size despite all the advances in communications technology since the First World War. Rather, it is as though the planners have discovered, by trial and error over the centuries, that it is hard to get more than this number of men sufficiently familiar with each other so that they can work together as a functional unit. It is still possible, of course, to run an army with larger groups, but at a bigger size you have to impose complicated hierarchies and rules and regulations and formal measures to try to command loyalty and cohesion. Meaning, when you get so big, you cannot create the social bonds that will maintain that unity. You have to impose it. This is what Rav Hirsch is talking about. You have to impose the building. It's an artificial building project to maintain loyalty. Below 150, Dunbar argues, it's possible to achieve these same goals informally. At this size, orders can be implemented in unruly behavior controlled on the basis of personal loyalties and direct man-to-man contacts. With larger groups, this becomes impossible. Right, you can control other people when the group is small enough. When the group gets too big, you have to artificially manipulate it so that people stay together. And this, says Rav Hirsch, was done through the ribbon of Napoleon, the badge of wearing the Roman uniform, whatever it might be in their figurative sense. If you continue, I don't know if anyone has Rav Hirsch's commentary on the Torah, but if you continue in that Rav Hirsch's that piece from Rav Hirsch. So he makes a fascinating generalized statement. He says this: the events of our chapter are not the only instance in history where lust for glory prompted the building of a quote-unquote tower, and the indiscriminate consumption of all else in order to obtain the building blocks for its own triumphs. These events are a recurring phenomenon in world history. History, for the most part, tells only about towers and imaginary glory, which Nimrod and his successors enticed or forced their nations to build. But simple human values, this is such a powerful line, simple human values, a person's conduct in the privacy of his own home, about such things history books do not tell. Such things, in the beautiful metaphor of our sages, are recorded only by Eliyahu HaNavi and Mashiach, the heralds and agents of mankind's ultimate redemption, and signed by God as witness, based on the Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah. Such a beautiful phrase from Rav Hirsch, because history, when we look at it, is going to talk about the big towers that are built. History is going to talk about the big, powerful Roman army. It's going to talk about the big, powerful, or the small and powerful Napoleon Bonaparte, right? It's going to talk about those powerful people that accomplished powerful things and made big names for themselves. But all of those big, tangible, and power-grabbing activities were at the sacrifice of the individual. History is a storytelling of nation creation, which is usually done through the sacrifice of people's individuality, but also the sacrifice of their individual morality and their value system. So whereas Parshas Korach, we talked about how that lack of that goal ultimately led to infighting, today we're talking more, I'm focusing more about the loss of the individual's thought process, the loss of the individual's value system. And for those who are even slightly politically inclined to follow the news, to follow the sway of the election cycle right now, so you might have recognized a similar phenomenon. Have you ever thought to yourself, how is it possible that everybody on one side thinks the same exact things and everybody on the other side thinks the same exact things? How is there no middle ground? How is there no nuance to the conversation of, you know, a person who's going to vote for one person but maybe disagrees with them on one or two things, or a person is voting for the other side but disagrees with them on a bunch of different things? For some reason, everybody sacrifices their own individual thought process for the sake of being on one team or the other team. Perhaps the saddest thing of all election cycles is the fact that we all have to shoehorn our own belief system into what one side thinks or the other side thinks. And this is something which I think is such a sad reality, but it's exactly how Rav Hirsch is talking about it. We create these structures, whether they're physical or spiritual or emotional or national. We create these structures that we feel like we have to be part of the winning team, or that we're part of some great, you know, accomplishment, that our vote is going to create this change in American culture, and we're going to come to power, and we're going to be the ones in control. And in order to accomplish that, we sacrifice our own ability to think. We sacrifice our own logic, our own value system, in order to vote. I just want to make it clear before people really get in the throes of the election cycle. In order to vote, you don't have to agree with every single, you know, platform issue of every single, you know, every single candidate. We have a duty to vote, and you should vote. But that doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that they're doing. You have to maintain your own personal value system while you're also doing your civic duty. And I think the second that we start to think that we're building some kind of powerful nation, we're building our own Migdal Bavel, we're building our own tower of prominence, and we're going to be part of the winning team, we're going to be part of something bigger. And in order to do that, we have to sacrifice what we believe to be true, and we have to sacrifice our own value system to do it. So then that is not what our purpose in our civic responsibility is when we vote. We have to maintain our individuality. We have to maintain our moral values. And if we're willing to sacrifice that, so then it's not worth it to build the tower. It's not worth it to build the tower. And I think that's what Rav Hirsch is getting at. Now, we don't have the sort of nation statehood like we once did. We have a democracy. We have representation. And therefore, it's a lot less of an issue, or it's a lot less of an aggressive, you know, mandate of fighting wars and things like that. But I think the psychology of it is the same, that we think that we have to believe one thing or we have to believe another thing, and we'll sacrifice our own individuality. We won't care about the loss of this person or that person, or in our sense, the loss of this value or that value, if it means that we'll maintain a brick, we'll maintain another stone to the edifice of our tower. I just want to remind everyone, before we go into the election cycle, of course, people are familiar with it. Don't sacrifice your own values. It's okay to say, yes, I don't agree with him on that position. I don't agree with the party on this position. I'm going to vote with them because I believe with the majority of their positions, or because I've taken a stance and, you know, this is more worth it than that. You don't have to agree with every single notion. And I think that's the lesson that Rav Hirsch is trying to say. That's the lesson of Migdal Bavel. Nasa lanu shame. The addicting power of being part of a, as Rav Hirsch said, a hollow idol, right? An empty idol. Never sacrifice your own individual worth for the hollow idol or the empty idol that is the nation or the some kind of nasa lanu shem, let's make a name for ourselves. So always interesting when it's around election cycle that everything we think about is sort of tied into that. But I think this in particular is a message which speaks very loudly to that notion, to that cause. And hopefully we can all maintain our own individuality while we go into this election cycle and make the choices we have to make to accomplish our civic duty without sacrificing who we are as people, who we are as Jews, and what values we should hold to steadfastly at the expense of being part of that tower. Okay. Shkayach, everyone. Something to think about.
Thank you.